I love the book of Ecclesiastes. I always have. It's been a very intriguing book. But if you're ever going to study and appreciate the book of Ecclesiastes, you have to understand the worldview that Solomon had when he wrote this book. Solomon had a worldview of things that were happening under the sun. And that's the key word in Ecclesiastes. And his worldview affected his behavior, did it not? And it's the same today. If a person has a worldview today of humanism or evolution or atheism, it's going to affect his moral behavior. It can't help but affect that behavior. It's going to affect his demeanor and his attitude toward life. I'm always amazed when I'm traveling that I'll eat at a restaurant, I'll stay in a hotel, I'll get on an airplane, and there'll be people who are just unbelievably rude to the people who are trying to serve them. And I've always remembered this story that I heard several years ago, that a man had walked into the airline counter to get his ticket. And as he was sitting there waiting, the crowds were heavy and tempers were short, and everybody was trying to get the lady behind the ticket desk to get their ticket to her. And finally, this one man steps up and he says, "Do you know who I am?" And she immediately picked the phone up and she called security, and she said over the PA system, "We need security at counter number 3. We have a man here who doesn't know who he is." And the demeanor of that man, or those that he illustrates, those that look at the world in a pessimistic way. Ecclesiastes could be a pessimistic study. In fact, the first time that I ever read Ecclesiastes, in my mind I'm thinking, well, Solomon must have had a sour look at the world, and he must have left God out of the picture. So you have to remember this, that when Solomon wrote this book, God, by inspiration, recorded what he was writing and even his thoughts, but it doesn't necessarily mean his thoughts are true. It's just a reflection of his wisdom and his experiences. It's sort of like when the devil tempted Eve and he said, "The day you eat of this fruit, you will not die." That's an inspired account of the lie that the devil told. So keep that in mind when you're studying the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, for these two chapters, if I were giving a title to these two chapters, I'd actually look at two different studies. And the first of these, in chapter 9, I would call Enduring the Inevitability of Death. Well, that's a pessimistic study in and of itself, is it not? It's very fatalistic. And it's interesting that we tend to soften the reality of death. We call it passing away, pushing up daisies, 6 feet under. But how often do you have somebody say, "He died"? And yet the reality of death is something you can't ignore. So how are you going to deal with it? How are you going to face death? And that's what chapter 9 is about, and we'll look at some points relative to that. And then chapter 10, Solomon tries to get us to recognize the harm of folly and foolishness. And he does in a lot of the writings. And Proverbs and Ecclesiastes are just chock full of these statements about the foolish and the fools and those who just simply ignore God's word. So we're going to get as much of this in as we can, and then we'll close with two or three practical lessons that I hope that you can take with you. Let's concentrate on chapter 9, how to endure the inevitability of death. Now, the thought actually starts in chapter 9, verse 2, but chapter 8 and verse 17 and leading on into chapter 9 and verse 1 helps me to understand this pessimistic attitude by which Solomon was approaching this subject. Back up into chapter 8, read with me starting with verse 17. "Then I beheld all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because however much a man labors to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, moreover, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it." That sounds sort of like the sophisticated silliness of the humanists in our colleges today. You can't know truth, but they speak it as if they know truth. I attended East Central University in Oklahoma. I had a history teacher who was an avowed atheist. He was humanistic to the core. And one day he made this observation. He said to the class, You can't be certain about any conclusion you draw. And I raised my hand, and when he called on me, I said, are you certain about that? That's the only class I made a C in. I made A's and B's and everything else. But you see, that's the way the world thinks, and that's the way that Solomon was thinking. But he was looking at the world under the sun. And if you just look at the world from what you can observe, you'll never know about God, His nature, His character, and what He requires of us. And you certainly won't know, separate and apart from revelation, what lies beyond the gates of death. You can't know without divine revelation. So we ought to be thankful that God has given it to us. Now, let's talk about some points regarding death. First of all, in verses 2 through 4, he talks about the inevitability of it. If death comes to all. That's no great revelation. I can pass a cemetery. I can read the obituary in the morning newspaper. And I know that eventually I'm going to die. And I hate to tell you this, you're going to die. If you know Doug Martin, who's my associate worker there at Hanley, he's got a great personality, and he's a very practical man in much of his life. And I went in to get a soda pop out of the refrigerator one day, and he said, if you drink that, you're going to die. And I said, what makes you think that? He said, you will eventually. Well, I'm going to die if I don't drink it. The fact is, we're all going to die. It's appointed unto men once to die. And after that comes the judgment. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27. And when I think about that, I think about it being an appointment. An appointment. You ever missed an appointment? I missed a real important appointment one time. We had a wedding that had the rehearsal 1 week before the wedding. It's a little unusual. But the night of the rehearsal, I forgot all about it. I was sitting in my office down at the building, and I got a telephone call, and somebody said, have you forgotten the rehearsal? And immediately I rose. I made everything right. I apologized to the bride and the groom-to-be, but I had missed that appointment. There's an appointment you're not going to miss. None of us are going to miss. And though you may miss appointments on your calendar, you're not going to miss the appointment with death and with eternity and standing before God in the judgment day. Let's read verses 2 and 3. All things come alike to all. There's one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good, to the clean, to him that sacrificeth, and to him that sacrificeth not, as is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth is he that feareth an oath. It doesn't make a difference who you are in life. You're going to die. We're going to face death. And so he presents the inevitability of this death. As he tries to say, if you're going to endure the reality of that, just face up to the fact it is a reality. And then deal with it. Hopefully, as I read and study God's Word, I have a way to deal with it that the humanist doesn't have. I've often heard, we summarize this mindset something like this. There are no atheists in foxholes. I don't know how true that is. But there's a spiritual nature of man, and if we rob man of his belief in God, it's going to be filled with something. That void is going to be filled with something. So Solomon is saying here to us, it's real, and it affects our life. If you take the world view and you look at death, there's really not any difference, is there, between the way that Paul lived and Hitler lived in the final analysis. They've both gone to the grave. And wherein is the difference of their existence now if there is no God in heaven? But there is a God in heaven. The second point that he makes, beginning in verse 4 and going down through verse 6, is while you're alive, there's hope. You remember when that child that David had conceived with Bathsheba, and it was sick and was going to die, and David prayed earnestly. And then when the child died, he got up and he washed himself. And the question that his servants asked was, why is it that you were grieving so much while the child was alive? And now you're up and you've washed your face. He said, I can't bring the child back. I can go where the child is, but I cannot bring that child back. I think that's something akin to what Solomon is saying here. As long as there's life in an individual, there's hope. Doctor comes in and says to the family, it's terminal. It's a terminal illness. And so we struggle with the medical facilities to prolong the life of the individual in hopes, hoping that somehow we'll be able to restore the health of that individual. And as long as they're alive, that hope is there. It's something we cling to. in order to give us courage and in times of despair. I love this little concept that B.C. Goodpasture expressed with regard to hope. Let me just read it to you. In the hour of bleak adversity, hope holds forth the heartening prospect of something later on. It is hope that gives wealth to the beggar in quest of alms, victory to those in the dust and ashes of defeat, freedom to the galley slave chained to his oar, release to the prisoner in his cell, health to the sick upon whose faded cheek has settled the hectic flush of death. It's hope that saves the Christian when the bitter night of utter helplessness settles over him. It is hope that brings to him the promise of life in the presence of death. It happens to the humblest saint that in the night of death, hope sees a star and listening love hears the rustle of a wing. It is hope that enables the believer to say tomorrow in response to earth's last good night. It is hope that makes death a narrow starlit strip between the separation of yesterday and the fond reunion of tomorrow. What would life be without hope? Now listen to what Solomon says in these three verses, 4, 5, and 6. For to him that is joined with all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. By the way, the dog here is not our common concept of a domesticated dog. I have a little 5-pound poodle. When she's dripping wet, she's 5 pounds. And she's a sweet little thing to have around the house. He was not talking about a domesticated pet here. He was talking about two wild animals. And the dog that is alive is better than the dead lion. Is he not saying, in essence, at least the dog still has hope? The dead lion doesn't have any hope. Verse 5, for the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Seventh-day Adventists and those who believe in annihilation, they say when you die, all your memory's gone. I don't think that's what Solomon is saying here. But even if he was saying that, that's Solomon saying that and not God saying that. And when we move over to the New Testament, to the Christian dispensation, and we see that life and immortality was brought to light through the gospel of Jesus Christ, I learned there is something beyond this life. From the instant I breathe my last breath and I enter into eternity, my eyes will behold the glory of God, or my eyes will behold the torments that will be mine for all eternity. Consciousness does exist at death. And as Tom Warren pointed out in his wonderful book, Immortality, he said, one of the most sobering truths to him was this, that every single one of us are going to exist. We're going to be conscious from now on. Isn't that a sobering thought to think about? So Solomon is saying, while you're alive, there's hope. Cling to that hope. But the Christian has the kind of hope that reaches beyond the grave. The atheist and the humanist only have hope that is limited to this life, and that's not very much, is it? The third thing that Solomon focuses on begins in verse 7, and it goes down through verse 10. And he says, in essence, even though it looks pessimistic, and even though you know you're going to die, he says, enjoy life. Enjoy life. Read with me, starting with verse 7. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart. For God hath already accepted thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let not thy head lack oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of thy life. Isn't that strange that a man who took upon himself so many concubines and wives would write and instruct others to live joyfully with the woman of your youth? He's saying, live life, enjoy it fully, so that you may be able to get the fullest out of life. And the way to do that, by the way, just sort of a side lesson here, I can't think of any group of people who can enjoy life more than the Christian. We have a reason for living, and we have a hope beyond the grave. So Paul writes to us in Philippians, rejoice always. And again, I say rejoice. I preached a sermon one time in Oklahoma in a gospel meeting, and afterwards this lady came out and she had a sour look on her face, and she said, well, I'd tried to interject a little bit of humor, and she came out and she said, I don't believe in humor. I said, I can tell. And she didn't attend any more of the meetings. But there are people like that. And even though they claim to be a Christian, they wear this sour look. As one preacher used to say, they look like they've been baptized in vinegar juice. We ought to be a joyful people. Now, how are you going to get the most out of life? It's not done by indifference. It's not accomplished by a lackadaisical attitude toward life itself. Look, if you will, at verse 10. Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with thy might. For there's no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in Sheol, whither thou goest. In other words, you put the best into life, and you're going to get the best out of life. And that applies to preachers, the faithful Christians, elders, any of us. That if you expect to get joy out of life, you've got to put something into it that'll give you that joy. Quit feasting on things that are negative. I had an episode here about 2 weeks ago. I went to my doctor. The doctor's analysis was you're suffering from hypertension stress syndrome. I don't know what that means. My blood pressure was elevated a little bit. And so we talked through a scenario. What troubles you? What makes you anxious? I said, disruptions at the office. Okay, get out of the office. Spend half a day away where nobody can call you. Get off into a park or a closet somewhere. Take your cell phone and turn it off, but get away from the things that cause you stress. Driving in traffic stresses me. Don't get into traffic, the doctor says. I said, living in Fort Worth, Dallas, you can't avoid it. It's like that all the time. But you see, you have to put everything that you have into making life worthwhile if you're going to enjoy life. And although death is inevitable, we should seek to make the best out of life. And that is true wisdom, is it not? Moving over to verse 11 and 12, I would title it like this. Still looking at death in the overall broad perspective. Expect the unexpected and take whatever comes your way. That's great advice. But read verse 11 and following. I return, it's all under the sun. That the race is not to the swift. The story of the hare and the tortoise teaches us that lesson. It's not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. I think the point that Solomon was trying to teach us was, you can't control circumstances in life. And sometimes circumstances will shock you. Job must have been absolutely shocked. In less than, no doubt, just a few hours, his family was taken away from him. His flocks were taken away from him. His health was taken away from him. And his companionship of his wife was taken away from him. When she said, just curse God and die. What a great companion that is. But here was Job, and all this caved in on him. Circumstances that come so quickly. And life's misfortunes can change just like that. Just like that. And that's why in verse 12, he says, for man also knoweth not his time, and the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, even so are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. James put it something like this in James chapter 1. When you in a high estate are brought to a low estate, you're still to rejoice. If you go from a low estate to a high estate, rejoice. But always remember that everything that you have comes from God. And I think you'll be able to maintain that balance. Expect the unexpected and take whatever comes your way. Sometimes we don't like what comes our way. But you remember that we were told to do all things without murmuring. That's a challenge sometimes. Especially when times are difficult. And circumstances are not the best as they could otherwise be. Now when you get to verse 13, I think he still has this view of death in mind. And he tries to give us an illustration about the value of wisdom over just simple strength. You remember what David said in Psalms chapter 90? He said, there's an expected lifetime that we have. 60, that would be 60. If by reason, 80, that would be 80. Yet, life becomes a burden. My dad turns 90 years old next year. And he said, if I knew it was going to be like this, he said, I think I would have taken better care of myself. But those of you that are up in years, we know that the physical body breaks down. And I think the point that he's trying to say is, it's not just the strength you need through life. It is the wisdom you need. And so many times wisdom wins out over strength. And he tells this beautiful little story here in verse 14. There was a little city. I don't think there's any reference to any historical event here. In fact, one translation reads, what if there was a little city? Suppose there was a little city. And so it's a parable. It's a story to help me grasp what's coming. He said, there was a little city and few men within it. And there came a great king against it and besieged it, built great bulwarks against it. So here's these people in the city that see this king about to lay siege to their city and destroy them, perhaps lose their lives. And then verse 15, there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. And yet no man remembered the same poor man. Isn't it amazing sometimes how those in great humility and desire to serve others are not remembered by those that are great? They're soon forgotten. The story of Joseph, I think, demonstrates that. As he interpreted the dream of the baker and the butler, and the baker would be restored. And you remember what Joseph said to the baker when he was about to leave the prison and go back to the king's side? He says, remember me. Tell about me to the Pharaoh. But the butler forgot about him. And so it is that sometimes those in their humility and their serving attitude, they want to do what's right, and they exercise wisdom to the advantage over those that are strong, and yet they're forgotten, and their names are never remembered. I'm grateful for those people in the Lord's church who work in the background, whose names never come before others, those who are doing things that make for the success of a congregation, and we ought to be grateful for those, because sometimes in their wisdom, they're the ones that help the church to grow, and we very seldom give them the honor that they're due. Wisdom overcomes strength. And so as he closes this in verse 16, this section about life and death, he said, then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and the words are not heard. So they don't listen. I've sometimes told people, I know the answer to our nation's ills. It's right here in God's word. But who's listening? Nobody's listening. And you can scream from the halls, and it seems like people don't listen. So verse 17, the words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys a lot of good. Boy, how true that is. Let's move quickly to chapter 10. In chapter 10, you have he addresses folly. And he wants me to understand the harm of folly. Now, I think that chapter 10, verses 1 through 3 are sort of an introductory to what he's going to say following this. And what he tries to get me to see in verses 1 through 3, that folly needs to be deplored. It needs to be despised. We need to turn away from folly and do all within our ability to embrace divine wisdom and to shun human folly. Unfortunately, we live in an age where people are embracing folly and they're not embracing divine wisdom. So he's going to tell you three reasons why you ought to deplore it. Verses 1, verse 2, and verse 3. These three reasons. Number one, you need to deplore folly because it mars the beauty of wisdom. Look at verse 1. Dead flies cause the oil of the perfumer to send forth an evil odor, and so doth a little folly outweigh wisdom and honor. Just a little contamination. Galatians 5 in verse 6, Paul said, don't you know that a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump? And the message of Paul in Galatians 5 and of Solomon here is that you can mar the beauty of wisdom by just a little bit of foolishness. Have you ever noticed that many sins are just a marring of other things that are otherwise beautiful? Adultery mars the marriage institution. Lying mars the truth. I'm not saying that's applicable in every sin, but what Solomon is saying is you ought to abhor folly. You ought to turn away from it because it destroys the beauty of wisdom. And you can see that being played out in our generation. That the wisdom of God is being ridiculed today. It's being mocked as it's something foolish. And why? Because folly is being elevated in our society, and so it's erasing the beauty of the wisdom that comes from God's Word. And Satan is having a heyday because of that. Number two, in verse two, folly needs to be abhorred because it's an unsafe guide. It's not worthy of committing your life to it. Look, if you will, at verse 2. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Isn't that interesting? We sometimes say, well, he's moving to the left. You ever wonder where those phrases come from? He's moving to the right. They use the same terms in politics. He's to the right or he's to the left. Well, you get it from the Bible. And this is one verse in which reference is made to that. Here's a man whose heart is to the right. It leans towards what is right. And thus, he exercises wisdom in his life. And his walk demonstrates that. So if the walk of wisdom demonstrates a heart that is what it ought to be, then I don't want to use folly for my guide. David wrote in Psalms 119 and verse 105, "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." How grateful we ought to be that we have a guide that transcends all human wisdom and all human thinking. In fact, it comes from heaven itself. And then last of all, in verse 3, he says you need to deplore folly because eventually folly is going to betray its own stupidity. I read just this week of a man who was successful. He and his friend were successful in committing a bank robbery. It may have been a store. Anyway, it was a robbery. And when they got home, they just couldn't stand themselves. And they got on Facebook and told what they had done. They revealed their own stupidity. You ever read these examples of the stupidity of criminals? They abound. That's an example of what Solomon is talking about. And you look at the foolishness of the evil mind, and so many times they display their stupidity. That's why Solomon probably said, "Answer not a fool according to his folly." And then he turns right around and he says, "Answer a fool according to his folly." That's a challenging verse, is it not? So he introduces it in verses 1 through 3. Now he's going to tell me some things about the effect of this folly. First of all, in verses 8 down through verse 10, he focuses on the fact that folly often manifests itself in government. Boy, how true this is. Well, verses 4 through 7, it manifests itself in government. "If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place." I really wrestled with this verse, but I came to this conclusion that what he was saying is, if you've got a ruler that uses foolishness and he says something, don't just resign. You stay put and try to render a good influence. Now, sometimes you have to finally wipe the dust off your feet and go on. But as long as possible, you stay put. Because our government hates Christianity, and because we're facing a persecution now, the likes of which we have never seen in our country, this is not the time for the Christian to give up and quit. It's the time to double down and preach and teach the gospel of Jesus Christ. So he tells me then that it affects government. It has a diametric effect on what happens. And so in verse 5 he says, "There's an evil which I've seen under the sun, as it were an arrow which proceeds from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity." Boy, you talk about relative. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in the low place. I think the rich here are the rich in wisdom. Folly is exalted, and those rich in wisdom now are demoted. Well, that's a description of where we are today. When stupidity and foolishness are looked upon as genuine wisdom, wrong is elevated as right, and, well, you get the picture. And so then verses 8 now through, I'm going to have to skip some of this. Do I have 5 minutes when you come up here? 5 minutes. Simply because I hope you'll read the rest of chapter 8 when the book comes out and take some time, because it's an amazing passage that refers to a chapter that refers to just folly in general. But let me close with some lessons very quick. I'm going to give you 4 quick lessons in these last few minutes, and these come out of 9 and 10. Number 1, folly will mar and blemish even the best of people and the most noble of intentions. We recognize the name Alfred Nobel. Did you know that he invented dynamite? And one day, while he was still alive, his obituary appeared in a local newspaper. And for some reason, the writer of the obituary confused his brother's name with his. It was his brother who had passed away. And in the obituary, it said something like this. It said that Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite, who died yesterday, devised a way for more people to be killed in a war than ever before, and he died a very rich man. When Alfred Nobel read that, he decided he wanted to be known for something other than bringing destruction, and so he initiated the Nobel Peace Prize. And toward the close of his life, he was asked why he initiated the Nobel Peace Prize. And he said, every man ought to have the chance to correct his epitaph in midstream and write a new one. You see, folly will mar a man's life, and we have to be careful that we not allow that to happen. Here's a second lesson. Folly is not a safe guide. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet, a light unto my path. The wise man follows the counsel of God. The fool follows his own folly. And someone observed, I don't know who the author of this is, I just have it in my files. The fool makes a game out of wrongdoing and thinks sin is fun. The man of principle, on the contrary, draws his serene cheerfulness from faith in the divine law of things, the sense that he is reconciled to it and that good will flow from it. Remember, we talked about demeanor and attitude. When you have a worldview, your demeanor and attitude are affected. And then a third lesson, folly will betray its own foolishness. And the tragedy of it is that common sense is disappearing. Let me read to you a little parody. It's called The Passing of Common Sense. Maybe you've heard this. Today we mourn the passing of a beloved old friend, Mr. Common Sense. Mr. Sense had been with us for many years. No one knows for sure how old he was, since his birth records were long ago lost in bureaucratic red tape. He'll be remembered as having cultivated such valuable lessons as knowing when to come in out of the rain, why the early bird gets the worm, and that life isn't always fair. Common Sense lived by simple, sound financial policies. Don't spend more than you earn. And reliable parenting strategies. Adults, not children, are in charge. His health began to rapidly deteriorate when well-intentioned but overbearing regulations were set in place. Reports of a 6-year-old boy charged with sexual harassment for kissing a classmate. Teens suspended from school for using mouthwash after lunch. And a teacher fired for reprimanding an unruly student only worsened his condition. Mr. Sense declined even further when schools were required to get parental consent to administer aspirin to a student, but could not inform the parents when a student became pregnant and wanted to have an abortion. And finally, Common Sense lost the will to live as the churches became businesses and criminals received better treatment than their victims. Common Sense finally gave up the ghost after a woman failed to realize that a steaming cup of hot coffee was hot and she spilled a little bit in her lap and was rewarded a huge settlement. Common Sense is preceded in death by his parents, truth and trust, his wife, discretion, his daughter, responsibility, and his son, reason. 2 stepbrothers survive him. My rights, and I'm a whiner. You know what, really, the fool, when you look at the fool overall in God's Word, he's a man that just doesn't use common sense. But when you have a worldview that leaves God out, common sense goes with it, does it not? Let's hold to the divine wisdom that God gives to us. Let's love life, recognize the reality of death, and let's live in preparation for it and be wise as serpents. Thank you for your attention.